Buenos días. Vamos a dar inicio a la séptima conferencia de este quinto encuentro internacional. El tema a trabajar esta mañana es justicia militar en el derecho comparado, modelos y delito de función militar. El moderador de esta mañana es el almirante de escuadra Álvaro Luis Pinto, ministro presidente del Superior Tribunal Militar de Brasil, nacido en Río de Janeiro el 28 de mayo de 1945. El ministro Álvaro Luis Pinto llegó al Supremo Tribunal Militar por nombramiento del presidente Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, después de haber asumido el cargo el 25 de marzo del 2010. Entre 1991 a 1992, realizó estudios en Naval War College en Newport, Rhode Island, Estados Unidos. En la Marina, el ministro Álvaro ha ejercido importantes cargos, entre ellos, director adjunto del Hospital Naval Marcilio Díaz, director del Centro de Inteligencia de la Marina, agregado naval de los Estados Unidos y Canadá en Washington, director de Aeronáutica de la Marina, comandante del Segundo Distrito Naval en Salvador, director de personal militar y secretario general de la Marina, comandante de operaciones navales, director general de navegación marítima y jefe de Estado Mayor de la Armada. En el periodo comprendido entre 1985 y 1987, fue asesor del Gabinete de la Presidencia de la República y entre 1998 y 1999, en la Secretaría de Asuntos Estratégicos de la Presidencia de la República, se desempeñó como coordinador de programas técnico-científicos. Señor almirante, adelante. El almirante.
Querendo falar logo. Muito obrigado. Senhoras e senhores, muito bom dia. Nesta manhã do dia 28 de abril de 2011, acordei já com um sentimento de saudade deste quinto encontro internacional de direito humanitário e direito militar. E digo por quê. O elevado nível das apresentações de todos os palestrantes e a conduta segura dos moderadores, a organização perfeita disponibilizada pelos nossos anfitriões, a acolhida fraterna e amiga dos nossos companheiros nessa belíssima Lima, foram marcantes nesses últimos quatro dias. Não posso deixar de ressaltar, principalmente, a qualidade dos temas abordados em todas as conferências realizadas. Saímos deste encontro com a satisfação do muito bom, muito bem dever cumprido. E sabem por quê? Escutamos, perguntamos e aprendemos. Em nome dos magistrados e advogados que vieram me acompanhar nesta data, agradeço o convite que nos foi formulado para, neste encontro, pela Associação Internacional da Justiça Militar, em nome do seu presidente, Dr. Getúlio Corrêa, e principalmente ao almirante Mesa Augusto, pela acolhida e fraternidade com que fomos recebidos. Sem mais delongas, vamos ler o currículo do almirante Mesa Augusto. Contra-almirante Carlos Henrique Mesa Augusto, presidente do Fórum Militar Policial do Peru. Assumiu, entrou na Marinha de Guerra do Peru em 5 de junho de 1970, como tenente-primeiro do quadro da Justiça em 5 de junho de 72. Cursou aspectos legais de transações comerciais internacionais na Universidade de Illinois, Estados Unidos da América, e o curso básico de Estado-Maior e na Escola Superior de Guerra Naval. Entre seus diversos cargos que desempenhou na Marinha de Guerra do Peru, o contra-almirante Meza prestou serviços como assessor jurídico na Direção-Geral de Economia, assessor jurídico da Capitania dos Portos de Callao, assessor jurídico e legal dos 5 últimos ministros da Marinha, assessor jurídico do Despacho Ministerial de Defesa em 2 ocasiões, assessor do Comando Conjunto das Forças Armadas, assessor jurídico da Inspetoria-Geral da Marinha, assessor jurídico e legal do Estado-Maior-Geral da Marinha, auditor-geral do Conselho Supremo de Justiça Militar, presidente do Conselho Supremo de Justiça Militar de novembro de 2001 a fevereiro de 2005 e presidente do Tribunal Supremo Militar Policial desde dezembro de 2008. Passamos a ler o currículo do juiz Charles Erdmann. O juiz Erdmann é graduado pela Universidade do Estado de Montana e a Escola de Leis da Universidade de Montana. Interrompeu seus estudos universitários em 1966 por seu alistamento por 3 anos na Infantaria de Marinha, no Marine Corps. Reassumiu sua carreira em 1981, quando o designaram como oficial do Grupo de Juízes e Advogados, o conhecido GAG. O juiz Erdmann começou sua carreira civil como assistente do fiscal-geral do estado de Montana. Posteriormente, abriu uma oficina privada como advogado em Helena, Montana. Eventualmente, formou uma banca de advogado onde praticava todas as formas de advocacia. Operou esta até que foi designado como juiz associado à Corte Suprema de Montana. Em 1998, o juiz Erdmann se filiou à oficina do alto representante em Bósnia e Herzegovina e o principal trabalho de estabelecimento da primeira unidade de anticorrupção em Bósnia. Então, coordenou as forças de reformas judiciais na comunidade internacional e mais tarde foi nomeado como chefe dos direitos humanos e dirigiu o Departamento Legal. Em 2000, foi designado como juiz principal ou juiz titular do Tribunal de Eleição Eleitoral de Bósnia, sendo o primeiro juiz internacional americano na Bósnia. O juiz Erdmann serviu como juiz titular até que as responsabilidades foram transferidas à Corte Suprema da Bósnia em 2001. O juiz Erdmann, depois de trabalhou na reforma judicial como consultor da lei internacional na Sérvia e Bósnia. Foi designado pelo presidente George Bush no Tribunal de Apelação dos Estados Unidos para as Forças Armadas em outubro de 2002. Desde sua nomeação, o juiz Erdmann permaneceu ativo, trabalhando em várias reformas internacionais, judiciais e atividades que regulam a lei. O terceiro conferencista, o coronel militar Yukio Dogan, ele é o secretário-geral de Alto Tribunal de Apelação Militar da Turquia. Nasceu em 1965. Em 1984 a 1988, frequentou a Academia Militar, fez a Faculdade de Direito em Ankara em 1995, de 97 a 2001, foi juiz militar em diferentes tribunais, 97 a 2000, fez o curso de Direito, de Mestre em Direito Internacional Privado. 2001 a 2008, dirigiu o setor geral de assessoria jurídica de pessoal na Turquia. Foi assessor jurídico no Afeganistão e assessor jurídico em Kosovo. Em 2008, foi membro da Alta Corte de Apelação Militar e, em 2010, seu secretário-geral dessa corte fala inglês e muito bem, e o alemão também. Bom, vamos dar início à nossa conferência de hoje, cujo tema abordará o tema Justiça Militar e o Direito Comparado, Modelos e Delito da Justiça Militar, e passo a palavra ao nosso prezado contra-almirante Mesa Angosto. Com a palavra, ministro, o contra-almirante Mesa.
Es un placer dirigirme ante un auditorio tan distinguido para presentarle mi ponencia titulada La justicia militar en el derecho comparado, rol de garante de los derechos humanos, concepto de delito de función y modelo de organización de la jurisdicción militar. Estoy seguro que este evento nos enriquecerá mutuamente y estrechará vínculos de cooperación y confraternidad entre las justicias militares de todas las repúblicas participantes. En base a mi experiencia en la justicia militar, donde me he desempeñado como auditor general, fiscal general, vocal supremo y actualmente presidente del Fuero Militar Policial Peruano, estoy convencido de que los militares y policías deben ser juzgados en esta jurisdicción especializada cuando incurren en la comisión de ilícitos relacionados con el ejercicio de sus funciones. La jurisdicción militar no es un fuero personal ni un privilegio, ni ha sido concebida para promover la impunidad de los militares o policías que delinquen. Por el contrario, la justicia militar es una carga pesada sobre la fuerza del orden, pues esta jurisdicción es el instrumento que garantiza que los efectivos cumplan en forma idónea y eficaz sus funciones de defensa y seguridad de la República, pues de lo contrario recaerá sobre ellos una sanción rigurosa y ejemplarizadora. El recurso a la jurisdicción ordinaria es insuficiente para servir las necesidades de la disciplina militar. Bien señala el Tribunal Supremo de Canadá, caso Generó versus La Reina, y la Corte Constitucional Colombiana en el expediente C-473 del año 99, que el sistema punitivo de la jurisdicción militar es incompatible con el de la jurisdicción ordinaria, debido a que las reglas de comportamiento de los militares son extrañas a la vida civil. Por esta razón, el recurso a los tribunales civiles es inadecuado para servir las necesidades particulares de la disciplina militar. En suma, el fuero militar es una jurisdicción altamente especializada cuyo fin es velar que los efectivos del orden cumplan con disciplina e idoneidad y eficiencia sus funciones de defensa y seguridad de la patria. Fortalecimiento del Fuero Militar Policial del Perú. Antes de desarrollar el tema de fondo, quisiera relatarles brevemente la ardua batalla que afrontamos en el Perú para la subsistencia de la jurisdicción. La justicia militar en el Perú ha estado al borde de su eliminación debido a las maniobras que en el ámbito nacional e internacional de diversas ONGs de inclinación antimilitarista, cuyo objeto final no solo era desaparecer a la justicia militar, sino también a las fuerzas del orden. El 27 de diciembre del año 2008, asumí por segunda ocasión la presidencia del Fuero Militar Peruano con el compromiso de luchar por la supervivencia de esta jurisdicción. En esa fecha, el panorama era totalmente adverso. El Tribunal Constitucional Peruano había dictado 9 sentencias de inconstitucionalidad contra la justicia militar. La ONG Instituto de Defensa Legal nos había denunciado por tercera vez ante la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. El Colegio de Abogados de Lima anunciaba su demanda de inconstitucionalidad contra la nueva ley de justicia militar. Hoy me enorgullece informarles que hemos triunfado ante la adversidad y se ha logrado fortalecer el Fuero Militar Policial del Perú, y muestra de ello es la realización de este evento internacional. Ámbito internacional. En el ámbito internacional, en marzo del 2009, acudimos a la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos con sede en Washington para defender la situación de la actual justicia militar policial peruana. En aquella ocasión, desvirtuamos todas las denuncias y argumentos erróneos que esgrimió la ONG Instituto de Defensa Legal respecto de la organización y funciones del Fuero Militar Peruano. Nuestros argumentos fueron acogidos con beneplácito por los miembros de dicha comisión y, como muestra de ello, los comisionados Florentín Menéndez y Paolo Carosa nos mostraron públicamente su apoyo. Las expresiones de estos comisionados nos demuestran que la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos apoya la justicia militar peruana. En octubre del 2010 estuvimos presentes nuevamente en Washington para defender al Fuero Militar Policial del Perú en una audiencia temática realizada en la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. En esta ocasión, la ONG Instituto de Defensa Legal cuestionó el Código Penal Militar Policial. Al respecto, me complace afirmar que nuevamente nuestros argumentos fueron acogidos por la referida comisión. Por esta razón, en su informe final de sesiones, la comisión hizo caso omiso a las peticiones planteadas en nuestra contra. En marzo de este año, acudimos nuevamente a la Comisión Interamericana de Derechos Humanos por una nueva denuncia del Instituto de Defensa Legal. Esperamos que la resolución de la comisión sea igual a las anteriores. En el ámbito nacional, a inicio del año 2009, el Colegio de Abogados de Lima demandó la inconstitucionalidad de la vigente ley del Fuero Militar Policial Peruano. También participó la Defensoría del Pueblo en calidad de amigo curae, apoyando dicha demanda. Los argumentos del demandante fueron que el Poder Judicial no podía nombrar a los magistrados militares, que los magistrados militares no pueden ser oficiales en actividad, que los magistrados militares no cuentan con garantía de independencia e imparcialidad y que no puede existir una fiscalía adscrita al Fuero Militar Policial. Después de una ardua batalla jurídica, logramos en diciembre del 2009 el Tribunal Constitucional emitiera una nueva sentencia que confirmó la constitucionalidad, exigencia y competencia de la jurisdicción militar policial. Así pues, el Tribunal Constitucional en su sentencia 01 del año 2009 legitimó los siguientes aspectos a favor del Fuero Militar Policial Peruano. El Poder Ejecutivo sí puede nombrar a los magistrados militares. Los magistrados militares sí pueden ser oficiales en activo. Los magistrados militares sí cuentan con suficientes garantías de independencia e imparcialidad. Y sí puede existir una fiscalía militar policial. Esta sentencia del Tribunal Constitucional es un fallo histórico de los anales de la justicia militar policial peruana y ha tenido trascendencia en la defensa y seguridad de la República. La justicia militar y su rol de garantes de los derechos humanos. La justicia militar tiene un rol preponderante en la preservación de los derechos humanos, principalmente por dos factores. Primero, porque esta jurisdicción especializada es el instrumento que garantiza la efectiva defensa y seguridad de la República, lo cual es el presupuesto habilitador para el desarrollo de una sociedad enmarcada en una política de protección y promoción de los derechos humanos. Segundo, porque la justicia militar vela que los efectivos militares y policiales ejerciten sus funciones con estricto respeto de los derechos humanos, es decir, previene toda distorsión o exceso funcional que atente o lesione los derechos de la persona humana. La justicia militar, como guardián eficaz de la defensa y seguridad de la República y presupuesto habilitador de la plena vigencia de los derechos humanos. Las Fuerzas Armadas y Policiales tienen las trascendentales funciones de garantizar la defensa, independencia, soberanía, integridad territorial, seguridad y orden interno de la República. Para que estas funciones se cumplan en forma plena, resulta indispensable que se asegure la disciplina y el orden de estas instituciones, lo cual se logra primordialmente con la sanción de los delitos de función en la jurisdicción militar. En este contexto, es responsabilidad de la jurisdicción militar velar que las Fuerzas Armadas y Policiales cumplan debidamente con sus obligaciones propias antes referidas. Al respecto, la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, caso Berenson versus Perú, ha sostenido con claridad que las sanciones de los delitos de función en la jurisdicción militar inciden en la seguridad del Estado, el orden constitucional y garantiza el cumplimiento de las funciones de las fuerzas del orden. El ejercicio idóneo de estas funciones hace posible que los Estados cumplan con su deber fundamental de defender la soberanía nacional, proteger a su población de las amenazas contra su seguridad, garantizar la plena vigencia de los derechos humanos y promover el bienestar general. En estos tiempos, reiteramos, la justicia militar no es un fuero personal ni un privilegio, ni está concedida para proteger a los militares o policías que cometen delitos. Por el contrario, la justicia militar es una carga pesada sobre los efectivos de las fuerzas del orden. En este efecto, muchos delitos que son punibles con arreglo al derecho penal común asumen una connotación más grave como delito de función y como tal merecen un castigo más severo. Esto tiene especial relevancia en los delitos que atentan contra el régimen constitucional, el sistema democrático de gobierno y el Estado de Derecho. Por ejemplo, en el nuevo Código Penal Militar Policial Peruano, artículo 60, sanciona con una pena privativa de libertad de 25 años el delito de rebelión militar policial a efecto de proteger superlativamente al régimen constitucional y el Estado de Derecho en nuestro país. Lo mismo sucede con el delito de sedición militar o militar, que el Código Penal Militar Policial, artículo 62, sanciona con 15 años de pena privativa de libertad en aras de evitar que los efectivos del orden se levanten en armas para impedir el cumplimiento de alguna norma legal, deponer la autoridad legítima o participar en un acto de alteración del orden público. La defensa y seguridad de la República son los presupuestos habilitadores para la vigencia de los derechos humanos. Solo un clima de paz y orden interno es posible el desarrollo del sistema democrático de gobierno y un régimen político que garantice el desarrollo y promoción de los derechos de los ciudadanos. En contrapartida, un clima de violencia e inseguridad es el combustible para la violación de los derechos de las personas. La justicia militar como garante que los efectivos del orden ejerciten sus funciones con pleno respeto de los derechos humanos. Como hemos mencionado, la justicia militar vela que los efectivos militares y policiales ejerciten sus funciones con estricto respeto de los derechos de los ciudadanos. De esta forma, se previene toda distorsión, exceso o abuso funcional que atente o lesione los derechos de la persona humana. Cobra especial relevancia cuando las fuerzas del orden despliegan en máximo el uso de la fuerza, esto es, en situaciones de estado de excepción y conflictos armados. Por ejemplo, el Código Penal Policial Peruano vela con especial cautela que en tales escenarios el ejercicio de la función militar y policial sea acorde con la política de respeto y restricto a los derechos humanos. Así pues, el título segundo está dedicado a la sanción de los delitos cometidos por el personal militar o policial durante el estado de excepción y contra el derecho internacional humanitario. Los cuatro convenios de Ginebra de 1949 y sus dos protocolos de 1977 son los principales instrumentos del derecho internacional humanitario. Son un conjunto de normas que en tiempo de conflicto armado o interno protege a las personas que no participan en las hostilidades o que han dejado de hacerlo. Su principal objetivo es limitar y evitar el sufrimiento humano. En suma, la justicia militar asegura la efectiva defensa y seguridad de la República y con ello coadyuva a la preservación del orden constitucional y hace posible las condiciones de paz y orden interno que son necesarias para la plena vigencia y desarrollo humano. Asimismo, la justicia militar vela que la función militar y policial se ejercite con estricto respeto de los derechos de la persona humana, especialmente en tiempo de conflicto armado, evitando así todo exceso o abuso funcional. Concepto de delito de función, triple identidad del delito de función. La Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, caso Berenson versus Perú, ha definido el delito de función como toda conducta cometida por un militar en activo, en acto de servicio, que afecte a los bienes jurídicos vinculados a las funciones de las fuerzas del orden. En base a esta conceptualización de la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos, el delito de función debe presentar la siguiente triple identidad. El agente activo del delito de función es un efectivo de las Fuerzas Armadas o Policía en situación de actividad. El delito de función debe ser cometido en acto de servicio o con ocasión de él. El delito de función, sea por comisión u omisión, está dirigido a proteger bienes jurídicos vinculados a las funciones de las Fuerzas Armadas o Policiales. Bien tutelado por el delito de función. Asimismo, la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos ha precisado en forma clara la naturaleza del bien jurídico tutelado en el delito de función. Así pues, este órgano jurisdiccional supranacional ha señalado en la sentencia recaída en el caso Radía Pacheco versus México que es factible que conductas punibles en naturaleza común sean ventiladas en la jurisdicción militar, siempre que tengan relación directa y próxima con la función de las Fuerzas Armadas o afecten los bienes jurídicos castrenses. Por tanto, el delito de función puede tutelar bienes jurídicos de naturaleza exclusivamente militar o policial, así como bienes jurídicos de naturaleza común, siempre que tenga relación directa y próxima con las funciones de las fuerzas del orden. Definición modelo de delito de función. Un concepto modelo de delito de función puede ser el siguiente. El delito de función es toda conducta ilícita cometida por un militar o policía en situación de actividad, en acto de servicio o con ocasión de él y que atente contra los bienes jurídicos vinculados con la existencia, organización, operatividad o funciones de las Fuerzas Armadas o Policiales. Como se puede apreciar, esta definición de delito de función respeta plenamente la referida triple identidad que exige la Corte Interamericana de Derechos Humanos. En base a esta conceptualización, la jurisdicción militar puede conocer delitos de función típicamente militares o policiales y delitos de función militarizados, sobre la base de una concepción funcional de este tipo especial de ilícitos y su conexión con la defensa y seguridad de la República, siendo su fin tutelar bienes jurídicos militares o policiales, así como bienes jurídicos de naturaleza común que tenga relación directa y próxima con la función de las fuerzas del orden. Delitos de función típicamente militares son los delitos que tutelan bienes jurídicos exclusivos de las Fuerzas Armadas o Policiales. Ejemplos de delitos de función típicamente militares son los siguientes: violación de consigna, abandono de puesto de vigilancia, omisión de aviso o repulsión, abandono de escolta o comando, seguridad de las instalaciones y bienes militares, deserción, empleo indebido de las armas, inicio de operaciones innecesarias, entre otros. Delitos de función militarizado son los que tutelan bienes jurídicos que no son necesariamente exclusivos de las Fuerzas Armadas o Policiales, pero inciden en la existencia de la organización, operatividad o funciones de estas instituciones y que debido a su importancia, su transgresión es sancionada como delito de función cuando el agente es un militar o policía que ha actuado en el ejercicio de sus funciones. Ejemplos de delito de función militarizado son los siguientes: espionaje, rebelión, sedición, robo de armas, falsificación o alteración de documentos, ultraje a los símbolos nacionales, militares o policiales, etc. Modelos de organización de la justicia militar. A nivel internacional existen tres tipos de modelos de justicia militar: modelo europeo continental, modelo anglosajón y modelo alemán y francés. Modelo europeo continental admite la existencia de tribunales permanentes en tiempo de paz. Las justicias militares más representativas de este modelo son la italiana, española y las de Latinoamérica. Modelo anglosajón se caracteriza por la existencia de órganos jurisdiccionales militares de carácter permanente en tiempo de paz. Estos son convocados cada vez que se presenta un caso concreto. Las justicias militares más representativas de estos modelos son la de Inglaterra y Estados Unidos. Modelo alemán y francés permite la existencia de tribunales militares solo en tiempo de guerra. Después de la Segunda Guerra Mundial, en Francia se suprimió el fuero castrense, salvo para los ejércitos fuera del país o en tiempo de guerra, absorbiendo sus funciones la justicia ordinaria. Justicia militar en América. En América podemos distinguir dos grupos de justicia militar: las justicias que se encuentran dentro de la jurisdicción ordinaria y las que son independientes y autónomas. Justicias militares integradas a la jurisdicción ordinaria. Las justicias militares de Brasil, Chile, Venezuela integran el Poder Judicial. Brasil. La justicia militar en Brasil es organizada en justicia militar de la Unión y justicia de los Estados, siendo la primera competente para juzgamientos de delitos militares practicados por militares de las Fuerzas Armadas, esto es, Marina, Ejército y Aeronáutica, y la segunda es competente para juzgar a los militares de los Estados, es decir, policías y bomberos militares. La justicia militar brasilera está contemplada en el texto de la Constitución como un órgano de poder judicial sin subordinación al poder ejecutivo o las Fuerzas Armadas, siendo así autónoma en relación a estos entes, aunque participan militares en su estructura. Justicia militar de la Unión. La justicia militar de la Unión está compuesta por un superior tribunal militar y por 20 auditorías de la justicia militar situadas en 12 circunscripciones. De acuerdo con el artículo 123 de la Constitución Federal, el Superior Tribunal Militar se compone de 15 ministros vitalicios, 10 oficiales generales en situación de actividad y 5 magistrados civiles, todos ellos designados por el Presidente de la República. Los consejos de justicia se componen de un juez de derecho y 4 oficiales de las Fuerzas Armadas. Justicias militares de los derechos. La justicia militar de los Estados tiene como órgano de segundo grado a los tribunales de justicia militares de los estados, existiendo en Sao Paulo, Minas Gerais y Río Grande del Sur. En los demás estados, los propios tribunales de justicia de los estados que ejercen el segundo grado de jurisdicción. En relación a los órganos de primer grado, en semejanza a la justicia militar de la Unión, existe el Consejo Especial de Justicia y Consejo Permanente de Justicia, el primero competente para el juzgamiento de oficiales y el segundo para las prácticas. La composición también es similar a lo de sus pares de la justicia militar de la Unión. Me disculpen los señores brasileños que cometí un error, pero ese es el concepto que tenemos nosotros de la justicia militar brasileña. En Chile, por su parte, los tribunales militares son especiales, pero dependen en tiempo de paz de la Corte Suprema en virtud de lo dispuesto en la Constitución de dicho país. La Corte Suprema en la República es la instancia de más alta jerarquía y se integra con el Auditor General del Ejército cuando trata cuestiones del fuero militar. En segunda instancia, ayudan las Cortes Marciales, la Corte Marcial del Ejército, de la Fuerza Aérea y Carabineros y la Corte Marcial de la Armada. En primera instancia, se encuentran los juzgados institucionales. Actualmente, tengo entendido que la justicia militar chilena está atravesando por un proceso de reforma en su organización y funciones. Creo que es así, general. Venezuela. En Venezuela, los tribunales militares forman parte del Poder Judicial y son considerados tribunales especiales para proteger y juzgar personal militar. La organización de la justicia militar venezolana es la siguiente: Corte Suprema de Justicia, Corte Marcial, Consejo de Guerra Permanente y Juzgados Militares Permanentes de Primera Instancia. Justicias militares independientes de la jurisdicción ordinaria. Las justicias militares de Colombia, Estados Unidos, México y Perú son independientes de la jurisdicción ordinaria. En Colombia, la organización de la justicia militar es la siguiente: Corte Suprema, Tribunal Superior Militar, Juzgado de Primera Instancia del Comando General de las Fuerzas Armadas, Juzgado de Primera Instancia para el Ejército Nacional, la Armada, la Fuerza Aérea y la Policía Nacional, juzgados y comandos unificados. Me disculpen los colombianos también si no es en los Estados Unidos, me disculpará el ponente. En los Estados Unidos, existe un sistema de cortes marciales de tres niveles similares al sistema civil: una corte marcial general para los delitos graves, una corte marcial especial que trate los delitos de menor gravedad y la corte marcial sumarial para el personal enlistado que comete delitos menores. La Corte de Apelaciones de la Fuerza Armada de los Estados Unidos, compuesta por tres jueces civiles, es la máxima instancia judicial civil responsable de la revisión de las decisiones tomadas por las Cortes Marciales. Las decisiones de esta Corte son apeladas ante la Corte Suprema de los Estados Unidos. México. La justicia militar mexicana juzga todo delito cometido por militares, sea estrictamente militares o de derecho común. La Administración de la Justicia Militar Mexicana depende directamente del Secretario de Defensa Nacional, funcionario designado por el Presidente de la República. La jurisdicción penal militar es especializada e independiente del Poder Judicial, estando subordinada al Poder Ejecutivo. Su organización es la siguiente: Supremo Tribunal Militar, Consejo de Guerra Extraordinario, Consejo de Guerra Extraordinario y Juzgados Militares. En el Perú, el Fuero Militar Policial es una jurisdicción independiente del Poder Judicial por mandato expreso del artículo 139 de la Constitución Política del Perú. El marco competencial constitucional de este fuero se encuentra ubicado en el capítulo 12 de la Seguridad y Defensa Nacional de la Constitución, específicamente en el artículo 173, y dice: con finalidad exclusiva de administrar justicia penal militar policial en los casos de que los miembros de las Fuerzas Armadas y Policía Nacional incurran en delito de función. Cabe resaltar que todos los magistrados del Fuero Militar Policial peruano son oficiales del Cuerpo Jurídico Militar Policial. Estructura y conformación jurisdiccional. A. Tribunales Supremos Militar Policial. Tiene su sede en Lima. Está conformado por los siguientes órganos: Sala Suprema Revisora, integrada por tres oficiales generales o almirantes en situación de retiro; Sala Suprema de Guerra, integrada por cuatro oficiales generales o almirantes en situación de actividad; Vocalía Suprema Militar Policial, integrada por un oficial general o almirante en situación de actividad; Tribunales Superiores Militares Policiales. Son un total de cinco tribunales superiores, integrados cada uno por tres oficiales coroneles o capitanes de navío en situación de actividad. Los juzgados militares policiales son 29. Están integrados por un oficial teniente coronel o capitán de fragata en situación de actividad. Asimismo, existe una fiscalía militar policial adscrita al fuero militar, es decir, como un órgano fiscal independiente del Ministerio Público Ordinario. Justicia militar en Europa, España. La actual jurisdicción militar española está organizada en tiempo de paz como un órgano máximo que es la Sala Quinta de lo Militar del Tribunal Supremo de España. La Sala Quinta está compuesta por el presidente y siete magistrados, de los cuales cuatro de ellos proceden de la carrera judicial y los cuatro restantes del cuerpo jurídico militar, generales y almirantes que sean consejeros, togados o auditores. Conoce los recursos de casación y revisión que pudieran entablarse contra las resoluciones del Tribunal Militar Central y los Tribunales Militares Territoriales. El Tribunal Militar Central y los Tribunales Militares Territoriales también están integrados por militares letrados, es decir, abogados. Cabe señalar que cuando una conducta constituye a la vez delito común y delito militar, la jurisdicción militar puede conocer por excepción del delito común cuando sea la que entiende del delito que tenga la pena más grave. Ley Orgánica 4 del año 1987. Este criterio ha sido ratificado por el Tribunal Constitucional Español en su resolución 440 del año 2006. Italia. La justicia militar italiana circunscribe la competencia de la justicia militar a los militares que cometen delitos militares, no pudiendo juzgar en tiempo de paz a civiles ni delitos comunes cometidos por los militares. La Corte Suprema Italiana se constituye en una instancia de casación de las sentencias emitidas por el fuero castrense. El Tribunal de Apelaciones tiene cinco miembros, de los cuales tres son oficiales abogados y los otros dos son oficiales de armas. Los magistrados militares tienen el mismo régimen que los magistrados ordinarios. Reflexiones sobre la ética del magistrado militar. La carrera del magistrado militar policial no es una consagración laboral, sino una concreción profesional. Nuestro cargo de jueces y fiscales nos exige entrega de nuestras vidas a la justicia. Un magistrado que no dedique hasta su último aliento a la justicia nunca será un verdadero magistrado. En el magistrado militar policial, la rectitud de la conciencia es mil veces más importante que el tesoro de los conocimientos. Primero debe ser buena, luego firme, después prudente, la ilustración viene en cuarto lugar y la pericia en el último. Un magistrado, en conclusión, es el hombre que se entrega a la justicia y lucha por ella. Bien sostuvo Confucio que mejor que el hombre que sabe lo que es justo es el hombre que ama lo justo. Nuestro rol de magistrado nos exige tener la fuerza y la convicción, la definición de la justicia, el aliento para sostenerla, el noble estímulo para anteponerla al interés propio y el sentimiento lírico para templar las armas del derecho. Nunca ni por nada es lícito faltar a la verdad. El magistrado que se aleja del sendero de la verdad tiene gran similitud con el corrupto. Un magistrado es como la balanza de precisión, pues si se separa un milímetro del fiel camino de la justicia, origina la debacle de la sociedad. Hacer justicia sin ningún otro interés más que la justicia por sí misma, hacer justicia a quien nos ofendió, hacer justicia a costa de perder amigos o ganar enemigos, hacer justicia afrontando la injuria y la impopularidad. Todo esto es loable para el ciudadano común, pero no para el magistrado militar. En efecto, para el magistrado militar, hacer justicia no es motivo de congratulación ni mérito, sino simplemente su deber, su razón de ser. La magistratura implica per se ser justo. La justicia y la verdad son la dimensión práctica de la labor jurisdiccional. La justicia y la verdad son el actuar de acuerdo con los valores imperativos del derecho. Hering señala en su clásico ensayo La lucha por el derecho que cualquier injusticia que padece un hombre, por violenta que sea, no se compara con la que comete la autoridad judicial cuando viola flagrantemente la ley. Este jurista alemán nos recuerda que en los primeros tiempos de Roma el juez que se dejaba corromper era castigado con la pena de muerte. En suma, señores, el amor por la justicia tiene que traducirse necesariamente en el amor por la verdad y el consiguiente compromiso de establecer esta en relaciones en el seno de la sociedad humana. La ética no es una imposición ni un derecho, es la forma de comportarse y de ejercer atribuciones que la ley confiere para cumplir el juramento de guardar y hacer guardar la Constitución y las leyes, viendo en todo momento el bien y la prosperidad del país. La honestidad y la conducta honesta del magistrado militar constituye trascendentalmente el desarrollo, defensa y seguridad de la nación. Culmino esta ponencia con la siguiente reflexión de un destacado presidente del Poder Judicial peruano, don César Fernández Arce. La justicia sin verdad es inequidad. La justicia sin honestidad es una farsa. La justicia sin compasión es crueldad. La justicia sin independencia es servilismo. La justicia sin firmeza es debilidad. Finalmente, aprovecho la oportunidad para renovar mi compromiso como presidente del Fuero Militar Policial del Perú de luchar siempre por la justicia militar autónoma, independiente, imparcial, guardiana de las fuerzas del orden y protectora de los derechos humanos. Muchas gracias.
Chamo para proferir a sua conferência o juiz Charles Edelman. Por favor, com a palavra, ministro Charles. O juiz.
Good morning. I'd like to thank everyone for attending this morning. I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me, and I'd like to congratulate both the hosts and the organizers of this conference for really a world-class conference. The level of speakers has just been exceptional, and the amount of knowledge has just been outstanding, and I congratulate everyone who is involved in it. Today, I'd like to talk a little bit about jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction, involving the United States military when we are deployed in operations outside the United States. And as we'll see as we get into this, there has been gaps in our jurisdiction relatively recently, and there also has been situations where we have overlapping jurisdiction. Next slide. So we're going to talk about who can be tried by the U.S. in times of conflict. And, of course, there are the major categories: military members, civilians that accompany the force, prisoners of war, unprivileged enemy combatants. And the next question is, where can they be tried? And they can be tried, of course, in courts martials. They can be tried in the United States federal court system. And they can also be tried in military commissions. And so today I'd like to talk about all of those individuals who can be tried and where they may be tried. Next slide, please. First, I'll talk about the military courts, the courts martials, and we'll do a little historic overview. Interestingly, the United States military justice system predates the United States Constitution. Our military justice system, the first Articles of War, were adopted in 1775. The United States Constitution was not adopted until 1787. So we have a lot of experience, and it's interesting that even after all of that experience, we still are struggling sometimes with jurisdiction. The earliest Articles of War really didn't change very much until the early 1800s. There were a few changes, but basically it stayed the same until the First World War. And after the First World War, there was some discussion that there needed to be some revisions, but nobody really took any serious action because that was the war to end all wars, and they didn't think there'd be another big war. And so no action was really taken. Then we came to World War II. And in World War II, there were 16 million Americans in uniform, and there were over 2 million courts martials. And in those days, if an individual was in a courts martial, they were often defended by officers who had no legal experience. The procedures certainly weren't as transparent as the procedures in the civilian court systems, and many American servicemen came back to the United States and complained that they thought the military justice system should be improved. So in 1950, the United States adopted the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and it outlaws all of the normal crimes that you're familiar with in civilian life, the major crimes, minor crimes, rape, murder, assault, child pornography in these days, drugs, all of those types of crimes. And then there are about 14 very peculiar military crimes that you don't find in civilian life. And in addition, there is a general section that prohibits conduct that's prejudicial to good order and discipline in the military, and also conduct that tends to bring discredit to the military. That's the general article. The Uniform Code of Military Justice made the rules uniform for all the services. It was revised pretty significantly in 1968 and in 1984. So our last major revision was 25 years ago, and it may be time pretty quickly for another major revision. Now, Not only has our military justice system had jurisdiction over military members, traditionally, the military justice system has also had jurisdiction over civilians who accompany the force, and the Uniform Code of Military Justice continued that tradition. Next slide, please. Who is subject to the Uniform Code? Obviously, active duty members and retired members drawing pay. Now, we have about 1.4 million active duty members in our military. We have about 800,000 reservists. When those reservists are in active duty, they are subject to the Uniform Code. Also, if you retire and are receiving military pay, you are technically subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but that is rarely, if ever, utilized. We have about 2 million retired military people. Individuals who are serving courts-martial sentences, even though they're no longer in the military, if they are serving the sentence, they are still subject to the Uniform Code. In some cases, civilians who are assigned to the military, that is generally other federal employees who are assigned to assist the military. And of greatest concern recently are civilians who accompany the military, and that deals with dependents, the families of service members, and contractors. And in recent times, the number of civilian contractors that the United States military depends upon has increased significantly. Now, even though the Uniform Code gave jurisdiction over both dependents and contractors, in the 1950s, our Supreme Court found that that extension of jurisdiction was unconstitutional in times of peace. And the reason for that was two of the amendments to our Constitution. The Fifth Amendment requires that an indictment be brought by a grand jury. We have no grand juries in the military. And also, the Sixth Amendment guarantees trial by jury. And in the military, we have, in the courts-martial system, individuals are tried by a panel of officers selected by a senior military official. So the military code of justice at that point lost its ability to try contractors and dependents in peacetime. In wartime, it was still possible. However, another court decision came out and said that in order to exercise that wartime jurisdiction, it had to be a declared war. The United States has not declared war since World War II. So that took away all of the jurisdiction for Vietnam and all of the other conflicts that we've been in since World War II. And that created a jurisdiction gap for the United States over both dependents and other civilians that accompany the force. Congress recently addressed that by adding language to the Uniform Code of Military Justice to include contingency operations. And so now civilians that accompany the force in contingency operations are now covered. That has not been tested in the court systems yet, and we don't know ultimately how that will stand up. Next slide, please. We'll continue with who's subject to the Uniform Code. Obviously, prisoners of war who meet the Geneva standards. Any person who has violated the law of war. So this, the Uniform Code of Military Justice does provide a forum for violators of the law of war. That is not used very often. And then in addition, any person who violates the law of a country which is occupied where the local civil authority is superseded by the occupation. Next slide, please. Here is the structure of the U.S. military justice system, starting with the courts martial at the lowest level. Those are uniform judges, uniform panel members, individuals who are in the military. That's the first instance. The second instance is the courts of criminal appeal, and there is a court of criminal appeal for each service. Where the sentence from the court-martial is a punitive discharge or imprisonment for over a year, the case automatically is appealed to the second instance, to the courts of criminal appeals. The next level is my court, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. This is the first civilian court that a military member can be heard before when they are convicted. This is comprised of five members appointed by the president, and there is a requirement that they must come from civilian life. In other words, they can't have spent a career in the military and be appointed to the court, and that's to ensure our tradition of civilian oversight of the military. Our terms are for 15 years. Our jurisdiction, in most cases, you have to petition. You have to ask us to accept your case, and we will do that if there is good cause shown. If there is an error of law, if there's a constitutional issue, if there's a conflict between two of the lower courts of criminal appeals, we will accept those cases. Capital cases, cases where there's a death sentence, we are required to accept, and the judge advocate generals of each military service can certify a case, ask us to take a case, and in those situations, we are required to do so. If we accept a case and issue a decision, it can then be appealed to the Supreme Court of the United States. If we reject a case, if we do not accept a case, that ends the case. It goes no farther in our justice system. We are the final determiners at that point. Next slide, please. I have some statistics here, and we can go through those pretty quickly. This is the caseloads, and it shows the trends that we have in our military justice system. This is the courts martials, and in 2000 there were 4,731. In 2009, that number was down to about 2,800. But to put that in perspective, in 1961, we had 109,000 total courts martials. So you can see the trend has been down. Next slide. The courts of criminal appeals, same trend. In 2000, there were 3,100 cases. 2009, there were 1,600. And next slide, please. The Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, in 2000, we had 926 petitions that were filed, and we granted 125 of those. In 2009, that was down to 721, and we granted 88. Now, on one hand, it's good that we don't have as many courts martials, because hopefully that reflects that we don't have as much crime. But the practical consideration of that is that our young attorneys are not getting the experience in trying criminal cases that they used to, and that is of a concern throughout the system. Next slide. From a jurisdictional perspective, military courts have broad jurisdiction over military members, retired members, civilians accompanying the force, those who commit violations of the law of war. But from a practical perspective, the court-martial system in the United States is primarily used for those military members on active duty. And that's what it was designed to do. The military justice system was designed to promote good order and discipline. And that's its main purpose, and that's what it does. Next slide, please. I'd like to now turn to the federal courts and just real quickly talk about an interesting historical perspective. Prior to 1956, the only non-military venue for trying civilians who accompanied the force was in consular courts. And these weren't real courts. They were courts comprised of diplomats, U.S. diplomats in different countries. They were created pursuant to treaties, and they were used for both criminal and civil jurisdiction. The last one was in Morocco in 1956. When that was abolished, that went away. And so that took away the civilian jurisdiction for individuals who accompanied the force overseas. And of course, the Supreme Court at the same time took away the jurisdiction under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and that left a pretty big jurisdictional gap. Next slide, please. There's two types, general types of extraterritorial federal jurisdiction. One is our federal statutes, our criminal statutes, often will say in the statute that they apply outside the United States, that there is extraterritorial jurisdiction. But then we recently had a different approach, and that was in the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. That was designed to close that gap that we had in our jurisdiction, and it created jurisdiction over individuals who accompanied the forces, and it applied most, if not all, felony crimes in the federal system. Next slide, please. The Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act was enacted in 2000, and it applies to military members and civilians who accompany the armed forces outside the United States, and when they commit crimes or do acts that would be crimes if they were felonies committed in the United States. Next slide, please. But the term military there is kind of misleading because it has very limited jurisdiction over military members. It only applies to individuals who are no longer in the military. In other words, if a crime was committed by an individual in the military, they had since been discharged, they can be charged under this act as civilians. Or if an individual is still in the military and the crime he or she committed was committed with a person outside the military, and a situation of this may be a fraudulent scheme by contracting officials where a military member is involved in the fraud and a civilian is involved in the fraud, both can be tried together in federal court. Next slide, please. The focus of this act really was on contractors and the dependents, the families of military members. But the definitions were difficult to work with. It initially covered civilians employed by or accompanying the armed forces outside the United States. And there was uncertainty as to which contractors that covered, because many of the contractors that we have that are providing assistance are not contractors with the Department of Defense. They may well be contractors with the USAID or the Department of State or the Department of Treasury. And so the question became, who is covered? And that was uncertain. This is a significant problem, because in Iraq and Afghanistan, there are several hundred thousand civilian contractors that provide support. Next slide, please. So Congress amended the act in 2004, and it now covers civilians to the extent their employment relates to supporting the mission of the Department of Defense. Well, that isn't as clear as it might be, because what does that mean? For instance, the contractors in Iraq, which everyone, most that follow this area are aware of, the Blackwater situation, where private contractors were in a situation where 17 Iraqi citizens were killed. Those individuals were hired to protect diplomats, and they were hired by the Department of State. And so a question became, well, are they covered by this act? A action was brought against them in the United States. It was dismissed on other grounds, and it recently has been reinstated. But it still isn't as clear as it should be, and there will continue to be court decisions and legislation dealing with this. Next slide, please. This is the structure for the federal courts, trial and appellate. And I just put this up to show that it's difficult to prosecute these cases for a civilian federal court in the United States when the crime occurs in another country where there are language barriers, where the witnesses are thousands of miles away, where the evidence is, nobody often knows where the evidence is. And so they present a number of logistic problems for prosecutors in the United States to successfully pursue. It also takes a lot of coordination, and that's difficult as well. Most of these cases are tried in federal courts in the state of Virginia, and then it goes to the federal circuit court, and then eventually they'll go to the Supreme Court. But we haven't had any real appellate decisions on these yet. Next slide. The Act did close this jurisdictional gap, but how well that's going to work, we don't know. Questions remain. It's only been used in about a dozen cases so far, and in none of those cases has the jurisdiction been challenged, and that has not gone yet to the appellate courts. Next slide, please. Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about military commissions and the military commissions that were established after the attack of the United States on 9/11. And the question is, where should the perpetrators of these acts and other acts of terrorism be tried? That's the basic question. Is this an act of war? If it's an act of war, then a military commission is a logical forum for the trials. Is it a regular criminal act? If it is, then there's an argument that they should be tried in civilian court. Or is it both? And so those are the questions that are presented, and there are individuals who believe strongly one way or the other, and that debate is currently going on in the United States, and it will go on for a while. Next slide, please. From a historical perspective, military commissions have a long history in the United States. Traditionally, they've been used to try enemy belligerents for war crimes, and the war of law was directly applied. Usually the procedure that was followed is the same that was followed in courts martials, but they are different. They are on a different track than courts martials. In the United States, we used them as early as the Revolutionary War. We used them in the Civil War. The assassins of President Lincoln were tried in a military commission in World War II. We used them. The Nazi saboteurs that landed on the shores of the United States were tried by military commissions. Next slide, please. In 2001, there was a presidential order that created military commissions to try individuals who were involved in the attacks against the United States. They also established the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. But in 2006, the Supreme Court said that the administration, the president, did not have the authority to create the military commissions without a congressional act. Next slide, please. In response, Congress passed the Military Commission Act of 2006, and that reauthorized the commissions. It adopted procedural rules that were similar but not the same as the rules for courts martial. There were a number of legal appeals. The U.S. courts decided that they had jurisdiction to hear appeals from individuals who were detained in Guantanamo. As a result of those legal challenges, only six cases have been resolved under the commission system. And when President Obama was elected, he announced a freeze on the military commission trials and also announced that the Guantanamo Bay facility would be closed in a year and that they would try to start trying these terrorist suspects in federal court. Next slide, please. That ran into both political problems and the popular opinion problems. Even though they had jurisdiction in the federal courts, and even though 9/11 happened in New York City, the people of New York City made it very clear that they did not want the trials in New York City. And they did not want them there mainly because of the potential target that would create for additional terrorism. And there were also problems with closing the Guantanamo facility. The practical problem is, well, where do you put these people? And no state wanted to accept those individuals. So that was a problem as well. Congress revised the Military Commission Act again in 2009, and at this point now it meets or surpasses all international standards, and it provides for jurisdiction over unprivileged enemy belligerents, and those are individuals who are not entitled to prisoner of war status under the Geneva Convention. Those are the people that are held in Guantanamo. Next slide, please. Here are the guarantees that are contained in Article 75 of the first additional protocol. The current act meets or exceeds all of these requirements, and these are the requirements for people who actually qualify as prisoners of war. Next slide. What's the future? Well, in March of this year, President Obama announced that the military commission trials would be resumed. And that really was a political response. Congress had stopped funding or would not fund the removal of any of the prisoners from Guantanamo. And actually, I made this slide before the administration announced that the main suspects in the 9/11 attack would now be tried before military commissions rather than tried in New York City. They did not foreclose the possibility of future prosecutions in federal court, but right now it looks like for the foreseeable future, most of these trials will be in the military commissions. As far as the numbers are concerned, you can see there, excuse me, the Guantanamo currently has 172 detainees. 47 can't be prosecuted because of problems with the evidence or other legal problems, but they pose a very clear danger to the United States and other countries, and they will continue to be held. Their status will be periodically reviewed to determine when and if they should be released. We have 36 individuals who are awaiting prosecution, and they will probably now be tried in military tribunals. 89 detainees are eligible for release, but no country will accept them at this point. So until we find some place where they can be located, they will probably stay there. Of the 598 detainees who have been released, 81 have been documented to have re-engaged in terrorist activities, and 69 are suspected to have engaged in terrorist activities. So it's hard to judge who is safe to release from that. There will be a great deal more litigation over the use of military commissions, and of course there would be a great many challenges if the individuals were tried in federal court. And that's something our system is designed to deal with, and it will take some time, but I feel confident that ultimately it will be fine. Next slide, please. And real quickly, this just shows you the structure of the appellate process for the military commissions. And the point of this slide is to show this is outside the normal courts-martial structure. It starts with the military commissions, which are military judges, military members sit on the panels. They follow a procedure that's close to the court-martial procedure, but not exactly the same. The courts of military commission review, again, are uniformed appellate judges. And then the appeal to the civilian courts don't come to our court, they go to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. And then the appeal from that is to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I would imagine that most of these cases would be ultimately appealed there. So as you can see, even though our system has a long history, there are still areas of our military justice that we are continuing to work with and are continuing to evolve. Again, I would like to thank you for the invitation, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you.
Eu passo a palavra agora ao Coronel Wilksell Duggan, que vai fazer a sua apresentação com relação à Marinha da Turquia, à Justiça Militar da Turquia.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests. I am Military Colonel Judge Yüksel Doğan from Turkey. My position in Turkey is the Secretary General of High Military Administrative Court. The Turkish Military Justice Delegation here in Peru, a lovely country, for the first time. That's why thanks to the President of the Association and thanks to the President of the Military Police of Peru. And thanks to the Turkish embassy, he is among us, for the support of the delegation. This is the last day of the conference. I am sure you are a little bit tired, but be sure, I am the last speaker. And international humanitarian law says the audience must be treated humanly, not the speakers. This is a joke. The next one. Let's begin. First of all, I want to give information about the military justice system, procedural safeguards in military courts, statute of military judges, status of military judges, and training of military judges. Also, from the comparative law, case laws of the European Court of Human Rights concerning the Turkish military justice system. The next one. Here you see the general umbrella, general structure of the Turkish jurisdiction. We have constitutional jurisdiction, administrative jurisdiction, justice, and for the disputes, jurisdiction dispute, there's another court. And also we have military courts. It is a little bit sophisticated. And we focus on now the red one, military. And this, you see some Turkish words. These are the keywords. The next one. Here you see the military justice system. As you see, it is double-headed. The red ones are for the criminals, and the white one is for the administratives. And is a constitutional institution, and we have a special law for the military judges, special law for military prosecution, special law for military penal court, and special law for the military high courts. Second, and the Turkish Constitution, article number 156 and 157, is depends on the military justice. And here you see the full version of the Constitution. According to this regulation, military justice shall be extra by military courts and military discipline courts. As you see, the criminal courts courts also double-headed, criminal courts and discipline courts. These courts shall have jurisdiction to try military personnel for military offenses, for offenses committed by military personnel against other military personnel, or for offenses connected with the military service and duties. The next one. And this is also very important. Except in the wartime, military courts have no jurisdiction to try non-military personnel. In the peacetime, we don't have jurisdiction over the civilians, that means. Okay? The next one. The organization of military judicial organs, their function, matters relating to the states of military judges, shall be regulated by law in accordance with the principle of the independence of the court and the security of the tenure of the judges. From this point of view, it is the same with the civilian courts. The military judges enjoy all the right what the civilian judges have. The next one, please. And here the, you see the military courts authority. They have jurisdiction over the cases related with the military crimes committed by military personnel and the crimes committed by the military personnel against military persons related with the military service and duties. It was also, if the, a crime committed in the military area, we judged so far, but we had a constitutional change and we abolished this position. The next one, please. And in the military courts, there's a two type. Minor cases goes to the single professional military judge, and more serious offenses are tried by a bench of three military judges. Apart from the military courts, we have also disciplinary courts. So many countries says if they have only disciplinary courts, we have military courts. But in Turkey, it is different. We have military courts, also we have disciplinary courts. Disciplinary courts are formed of three commissioned line officers, not the military judge, and who are appointed for a period of 1 year by the commander before the judgment. Next, please. And we have also a military high court of appeal. It is the last instance court of review of decision and judgment given by military courts. From this sentence, we understand that if the subject is the purely military, it never goes to the civilian side. The last word belongs to the military judgment. It has four chambers. Each chamber has eight consisting military judges. And in this session, decisions are taken with union votes or mere majority of votes. And also it is very important, members of the Military High Court of Appeal are appointed by the Turkish President of the Turkish Republic. All the military judges can be a member of the High Court if they have experience and the rank is a lieutenant colonel. The next one, please. And here you see the structure of the Military High Court of Appeal. There are 36 members chosen by the President of the Republic. The next one. And if the question is disciplinary offenses, the commander has two options. One option is he can punish the serviceman in his authority. And if there is an objection, it goes to the next high level commander. And also the second option is send this serviceman to the disciplinary court. And if there is an objection against the disciplinary court decision, it goes to the higher disciplinary court. Next, please. And if the question is military crime, the military prosecutor prepares a verdict and sent to military court, and if the, there is an objection about the against the military court decision, it goes to High Military Court of Appeal. This is the criminal structure, and you see some of France senior prosecutor, senior judge, they work on Turkish general staff. Next, please. And this is the lovely building where we are coming from. This is the High Military Administrative Court. And here you see the view from the top of the building, Ankara. And here is the President, Brigadier General Abdullah Arslan office. He is here. Also here, this is my office. Only one window. Next one, please. High Military Administrative Court, according to our regulation, it is the first and last instance court for the judicial supervision of the dispute arising from administrative acts or action involving military personnel or related to military service. From this regulation, we understand that sometimes the government, if government makes some wrong for the serviceman, they have right to open a file to the courts. And as a court, we supervise or we control the government. If it is against the law, we cancel it. It has three chambers. There are five military judges and two line officers here in this court. In the session, decisions are taken with the UN votes or with majority of votes. Next, please. Also, the member of the High Military Administrative Court are nominated by the plenary assembly of the court and chosen and appointed by the President of the Turkish Republic. Also, we have two line officers, two staff officers in this court. These line officers are appointed by the Turkish General Staff and nominated by the Turkish General Staff and appointed by the President of the Republic. This is the hearing salon, and this is the entrance. Next one. Here you see the structure of the High Military Administrative Court. We have total 24 members. 18 are the professional military judges. 6 are line officers. And here is the president, and here is a lady from US visiting us in Ankara. Next one, please. And it is also very important for the procedural safeguards. The difference between the civilian side and military side, it is very narrowed. And according to General Criminal Procedure Code, the rights of fair trial and defendant's right has been the same in military courts or in civilian courts. Next, please. And also it is very important for the military judges for the making the decision impartiality and independently. All the judges shall be independent in the discharge of their duties. This is the Constitution's word. They shall give judgment in accordance with the Constitution, law, and their personal conviction confirmed with the law. This is the constitutional regulation. And right of the matters arising from the status of military judges are regulated similar to the civilian judges. From this perspective, there is no difference. Next, please. All the military judges are graduated from the law faculty at least 4 years. And they have the assurance to remain in the profession with the age, until the age 60. The normal, regular colonels in Turkish army with the age 52 go in the civilian, retire. But if the question is the judges, if they want to stay or to work, they have right to work until the age 60. And they are promoted upon the service records given by the Military High Court of Appeal. The commanders don't have any right to give any service records to the military judges. Next, please. Record document is not arranged for the members of the Supreme Court, of course. All military judges are appointed through the joint decree. Even they are member or not, all the military judges are appointed through the joint decree. That means Minister of National Defense, Prime Minister, and the President of the Turkish Republic. It needs a 3 signature. And after that, it's announced by the official gazette. All the military judges and prosecutors cannot be appointed to a different place or position before 4 years service. That means if somebody is not happy with the decision of the judges, they cannot appoint him to another place. Okay? Next one, please. Military justice inspectors only can examine the notification about the military judges. And only the Minister of National Defense may impose disciplinary sanction, disciplinary punishment for the military judges. Even the, in our system, Turkish General Staff is not under the structure of Ministry of Defense. It directly bound to the Prime Minister. Even the Turkish General cannot punish the military judges. Only Minister of National Defense has the right. And if somebody influenced the military judges, according to Turkish Penal Code, this is a severe punishment. Are forcing for those who try to change or to influence the decision of military judges. These are the guarantees for the judges, okay? Next one, please. And this is another part, training of the military judges. Internship for military judges takes 1 year. And these military judges are trained at the Supreme Military Court. Military courts or Court of Justice in the civilian side, and the Minister of National Defense, Justice Affairs Department. Next, please. And military judges are given on the job training by Minister of National Defense. Here you see an internship judgment. It is on the top of the, our building, in our library. Next one. And this is the last part of the presentation. As you know, Turkish law based on the European law system, and under the control or under the supervision of the European Court Human Rights. And they have two different type of decision according to Turkish military justice system. One is given in 1998. The civilian cannot be judged in the military courts, even you are independent, even you are a real judge or court. That's why we changed our constitution. The civilian in peacetime, we don't have any jurisdiction over there. Next, please. And the second one is the in military high court, administrative court, we have in each chamber two line officer, two staff officer. And it was given in 1996. And according to this decision, the military courts works impartial, neutral. There is no problem with the Turkish military courts. Next one, please. And this is the end of the presentation. We are ready for your question. Thank you very much.
Assim, estamos chegando quase ao final da nossa jornada do dia de hoje. E vou procurar ser conciso nas apresentações que foram realizadas, em primeiro, pelo almirante Mesa Angosto, em que ressalta principalmente as dificuldades que ele teve como presidente do Fórum Militar Pessoal para exercer dentro da política nacional e internacional a consolidação do seu tribunal. Principalmente porque o Fórum Militar é uma jurisdição altamente especializada, que tem por fim zelar pelos efetivos, que são os militares, com hierarquia e disciplina. Ele citou em sua apresentação os vários passos que teve que executar, tanto no âmbito internacional como no âmbito nacional. E com isso, ele conseguiu, ao longo de pouco tempo, principalmente no âmbito nacional, que fosse reconhecido a justiça militar e policial como efetiva para a condução da justiça militar. E ele, ao assumir esse posicionamento, ele lista de garantias dos direitos humanos. E ele fala muito claramente na sua apresentação que esta jurisdição especializada da Justiça Militar é um instrumento de garantia efetiva à defesa e segurança da República do Peru. E, em segundo plano, que a Justiça Militar vela por os seus militares e policiais que exercem as suas funções com estrito respeito aos direitos dos cidadãos. Dentro desse contexto, ele fala também que a Corte Interamericana de Direitos Humanos sustentou claramente, no caso Berenson e Peru, a sanção dos crimes militares na jurisdição militar, que incide a segurança do Estado e ordem constitucional garantindo o cumprimento das funções das forças. Outro posicionamento interessante que foi colocado, que foi quando ele cita que muitos delitos são punidos com base no direito penal comum, onde assume uma conotação mais grave como delito militar, como crime militar, e como tal merece um castigo mais severo. E citou o exemplo que no novo Código Penal Militar Policial Peruano, em seu artigo 60, como lhe foi falado, sanciona como uma pena privativa de liberdade até 50 anos, até 25 anos, do delito de uma rebelião militar policial. Com relação à justiça militar como instrumento de hierarquia e disciplina das Forças Armadas, ele fala ao exercer suas funções com pleno respeito aos direitos humanos. Isso é muito importante frisar. Isso torna isso de especial relevância quando as forças são empregadas nas situações de estado de exceção e conflito armado. A Justiça Militar assegura a efetiva defesa e segurança da República e com ela coaduna com a preservação da ordem constitucional e torna possíveis as condições de paz e ordem interna que são necessárias para a plena vigência e desenvolvimento dos direitos humanos. Depois ele toca no assunto que são o conceito de crime militar. A tríplice identidade deste crime militar. E aí ele trata, que eu não vou ler, não vou repetir, o que deve ser cometido no ato de serviço, na atividade da função de efetivo do agente das Forças Armadas, ou seja, tem que ser um militar. E depois toca no assunto também interessante, que é o bem jurídico tutelado pelo crime militar. Portanto, o crime militar de função pode tutelar bens jurídicos de natureza exclusivamente militar ou policial, assim como bens jurídicos de natureza comum, sempre que tenham relação direta e próxima com as funções das forças envolvidas. Segue-se da apresentação do almirante Mesa uma explanação muito rápida, mas muito objetiva, dos modelos de organização da justiça militar. Ele fala no modelo europeu, no modelo anglo-saxão, ele fala do militar, do justiça militar na América. E eu vou tocar aqui num ponto que é quando ele fala sobre a justiça militar no Brasil. Especificamente num ponto que eu anotei aqui. A justiça militar da União, ela faz parte do poder judiciário brasileiro. E ela, a justiça militar brasileira, completou no dia 1º passado 203 anos de existência. Ou seja, 1º de abril. E observa fielmente o devido processo legal, inclusive dentro do poder judiciário. Ela deu origem no passado à Defensoria Pública da União, que foi consagrada na Constituição de 1988. Outra coisa interessante é que as sentenças emanadas do Superior Tribunal Militar poderão, dependendo de caso, ser apeladas ao Superior Tribunal Federal. Ao Supremo Tribunal Federal. Muito bem, aí o ministro, o almirante Mesa, continuando, falou das justiças, do modelo de justiça alemã, do francês, e ele culmina com algumas reflexões que eu achei de suma importância nos dias de hoje. E gravei algumas delas, que foram as primeiras, que a carreira do magistrado militar policial não é uma consagração de trabalho sem uma consciência profissional. O cargo de juiz e fiscais exige entregar nossa vida à justiça. Um magistrado que não dedica até o último momento à justiça nunca será um verdadeiro magistrado. Outra coisa que ele fala com muita importância é que o magistrado militar e policial, ele precisa ter a retitude, a correção na consciência, que é mil vezes mais importante que o tesouro dos conhecimentos. Isso é muito profundo para quem julga. Primeiro deve ser bom, logo firme. Depois, ser prudente. E a ilustração, como é que se diz, o conhecimento jurídico vem em quarto lugar e a perícia em último. Com relação à apresentação feita pelo o nosso juiz Charles Edman, eu observei alguns pontos interessantes, que se o julgamento de civis é uma discussão hoje em pauta em todo o mundo, imagine para os Estados Unidos da América, que vive com suas forças armadas ao redor de todo o nosso oceano, vamos dizer assim, terras e ares. Para conciliar os julgamentos de civis nas suas atuações com as suas forças armadas fora do seu continente. Realmente é um trabalho difícil de resolver, e que, se durante 48 anos, se não me engano, foi decidido a questão dos civis que acompanham os militares, é aqueles que trabalham para os Estados Unidos. Imagine
quanto tempo levará para se consagrar uma jurisprudência perfeita com o assunto de civis, utilizando-se que os Estados Unidos utiliza para o fora do seu continente, Outra questão que foi levantada foi a questão de Guantánamo e os presos que lá estão. Então, o nosso querido juiz Edmond, Charles Edmond, ele disse da problemática, do problema que existe hoje na decisão, quem julga, se a comissão militar ou se fica com a proposta feita pelo presidente Obama. Só o futuro dirá. São problemas sérios que aconteceu a partir do ano de setembro, praticamente quase um mês antes de eu deixar os Estados Unidos como adido naval. É um problema sério, é um problema que não se sabe o que acontecerá, e os exemplos que ele citou aqui, que de tantos que saem, que são liberados, voltam a cometer o crime. E quem os vai receber? Passando pelo último palestrante, achei muito interessante o posicionamento com relação aos juízes, os inspetores juízes militares, na sua formação e também na sua continuada capacitação para exercer as suas funções. Isso é um processo que nós temos que ter cuidado, e a Justiça Militar Brasileira, além da Justiça como um todo, tem que se preocupar na capacitação, sempre procurando dar aos juízes e àqueles que labutam na Justiça, seja ela militar ou de qualquer situação, continuar dando essa competência para que acompanhe as mudanças que o sistema global, essa globalização nos traz, e no dia a dia, foi discutido aqui algumas coisas nessas duas últimos dias sobre a justiça, nova justiça, que envolve environment, a questão do tema do meio ambiente, terrorismo e outras coisas novas que nós temos que atualizarmos em termos de doutrina e acompanhá-las nas nossas justiças militares também. Muito bem, depois de ter falado algumas coisinhas, vou passar ao nosso debate. As perguntas. Temos aí 15 minutos, meia hora. Vamos ver. A primeira pergunta vem para o almirante Mesa. A pergunta é a seguinte: como é a linha de carreira do magistrado militar peruano?
Bueno, como hemos dicho, nosotros hemos tenido una guerra legal durante todo el año 2009-2010. En septiembre del año pasado ha salido la nueva ley de organización y funciones y nuestro nuevo código de justicia militar. Estamos en este momento en la implementación de todas estas nuevas leyes. Nosotros hemos integrado los tribunales, ya no existe un tribunal por cada instituto, sino están todos integrados. En cuanto a la carrera judicial del magistrado, la carrera comienza como juez, y como para ser juez necesita 15 años de formación jurídico-militar. Para ser vocal superior se necesitan 22 años de experiencia. Y para ser vocal supremo se necesitan 22 años de formación. Nosotros tenemos un centro de altos estudios de la justicia militar en lo que estamos impartiendo instrucción especializada y tenemos convenios con muchas universidades del país. Asimismo, hemos celebrado un convenio con el Ministerio Público, el Fuero Común. Tenemos un nuevo convenio que acabamos de firmar con el Colegio de Abogados de Lima. Estamos en conversaciones con la Corte Suprema para hacer un convenio de colaboración entre ambos. Entonces, ese más o menos la línea de carrera. Bueno, para ser juez y vocal, además se requiere tener maestría y doctorado en Derecho y varios diplomados como cursos básicos para ser juez. Es decir, nosotros estamos pidiendo mucho más requisitos que los jueces del Fuero Común. Ese es el reto que tenemos nosotros.
Bom, eu vou juntar duas perguntas. Qual é a experiência do magistrado militar? E como se pode, quando vai ser modernizada a organização do Foro Militar Peruano?
¿Cuál es la experiencia del magistrado militar? Creo que la acabo de responder. ¿Cómo se ha modernizado la organización del Fuero Militar Policial? Bueno, al haberse integrado los tribunales, que en realidad hace un mes o mes y medio que hemos ya realmente integrado los tribunales, antes existían 12 tribunales, o sea, de cada uno de los institutos. Esos 12 tribunales se han reducido a 5 tribunales integrados. Las fiscalías superiores eran 12, las hemos integrado a 6. Los juzgados, teníamos 82 juzgados en todo alrededor del país, los hemos reducido a 29. Las fiscalías eran 34, también las hemos reducido a 29, es decir, una en cada juzgado. Esa es más o menos la estructura de la justicia.
Agora vou passar as perguntas ao juiz Edmund. Usted referiu que em Guantánamo haviam 47 detenidos que representa um perigo para o United States of America. Quem, como, são classificados?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I think it is, how are the individuals at Guantanamo classified that cannot be tried but are deemed to be too dangerous to release? And I'm not an expert on the Guantanamo system, but my understanding is that their status is reviewed periodically to determine whether or not further action can be taken, either to try them or to release them. This gets back to the initial determination as to whether or not we are involved in a war, and these are acts of war that these individuals have committed, or whether it is a civilian crime. As you're aware, in a time of war, when individuals are apprehended on the battlefield, it is not unusual that they can be held until the hostilities are over. It certainly raises issues of international human rights, and that is on a collision course with the protection of society. So those are difficult questions, and I don't think there is any easy answers, but I think that consideration is carefully given to all the arguments. Thank you.
Outra pergunta é: por que os Estados Unidos não subscreve o Código Penal Internacional? A Corte Penal.
This question, I think, is why the United States is not a member of the International Criminal Court. And that's a political question that I will be careful with. Initially, the United States was involved in the initial discussions as to the formation of the court, but it became clear that the political body in the United States, the United States Senate, would not agree to our joining that. And that involves, to a certain degree, the global reach that the United States has and the responsibilities that go along with that global reach, and the concern that we may be surrendering some of our sovereignty over actions that we're required to take, that many countries don't have the same situation. It's certainly international courts generally, I think, are very good, and the recent experience, I think, has been quite good. But there are certainly concerns in the United States from the political people, particularly in Congress, that the United States not surrender any of its sovereignty. A good example of this is the recent situation in Libya, where the United States was very reluctant to become involved, became involved only when the African Union made the request that they become involved, and that they became involved through NATO. That probably is a situation where the United States may not have been involved if it was up to the United States only, but because of our force projection, there are many things that we can do that other countries can't do. And so the question then becomes, do we subject ourselves to a international criminal court that there are at least some concerns may have political aspects to it rather than strictly criminal. But I do have to say that those comments are my opinion only and don't reflect the government of the United States or my court or anybody but myself. Thank you.
Colonel Wilkson Duggan, who serves as defense counsel in military courts?
Thank you very much for this interesting question. Yeah, as I said before, Turkish law based on the European law system. We are not coming from the common law system. And we have in military courts judges, prosecutors, and accused. If accused wants a lawyer from the free lawyers, it is possible. If they don't have enough money or they cannot afford these lawyers, the association of bar will send a lawyer to defend this accused person. Thank you very much.
What type of offense are disciplinary person military crimes?
Okay. This is also an interesting question. All the offenses and crimes are depicted in the our court system. And disciplinary offenses, we have a law, disciplinary law, and all the offenses are depicted on this law. And also in Turkish military penal code, all the crimes are defined. And what is military offenses? What is military crime? For example, if as a soldier, we have to immediately the order of the commander. If the soldier, if the serviceman do not properly the order, it goes to disciplinary court, disciplinary offenses. If he didn't do anything and reject to do this order, it goes to military court. For another example, in Turkey, the military service is compulsory. And if a serviceman or soldier don't come to the service until the 7 days, it goes to the disciplinary courts, disciplinary offenses. More than 7 days, it goes to the military courts. Thank you very much.
Eu nunca falo a última, falo a penúltima pergunta, mas a pergunta não está, deve ser para o nosso juiz, Clark. Charles. A Justiça Militar dos Estados Unidos tem recebido questionamentos ou recebeu questionamento de ordem constitucional respeito à existência e validade por parte das ONGs, ONG, ou seja, não governamental.
The military justice system of the United States, you know, in our society, certainly is subject to observations and criticisms by any group. I'm not sure exactly what the questioner was referring to, but I do think that certainly in our system, it has been found to be a constitutional system. It's found to be a relatively transparent system. The rights of the individuals are safeguarded. Individuals, when they join the military and are accused of a crime, do not surrender their constitutional rights. And one of the safeguards that are put in place is the fact that every military decision that individual can appeal to a independent civilian court that is not a part of the military, which is the court that I sit on, and get a civilian review, and also can be reviewed by the United States Supreme Court. So certainly all systems are subject to criticism at some point, but I think that our system is a valid constitutional system that provides a very meaningful process for those accused of crimes in the military system. Thank you.
Acho que encerramos essa parte do trabalho de hoje e do quinto encontro. Então, cumprimento aos palestrantes que com brilhantismo e fizeram o tema se correr com suavidade e profissionalismo. Muito obrigado a todos.